mic.
I'm internationally known, yo. I'm internationally known
when I be on the mic.
It's to my real ill heavyweight hitters, dough getters, 50 ways to make figures. My they come on the spot to fail sisters, like the hair rail spitters, the kids on the ziggers ziggers. When it's ugly, then the club is lovely. Dogs be sipping Hennessy and bubbly. To my comrade, they keep it flaming hot on dangerous blocks, claiming spots.
William Michael Griffin Jr., better known by his stage name Rakim, is nearly universally acknowledged as one of the greatest MCs, perhaps the greatest of all time within the hip-hop community. He began his career as the MC of the rap duo Eric B. and Rakim. Where many MCs of the time developed their technique through improvisational battles, Rakim was among the first to demonstrate the possibilities of sitting down and writing intricately crafted lyrics packed with clever word choices and metaphors. His new book, Sweat the Technique, Revelations on Creativity from the Lyrical Genius, follows his career from his beginnings as a teenage rapper on Long Island and offers insight into how he thinks about words, music, writing, and rhyming as it teaches writers of all ages how to hone their craft. I spoke with Rakim on stage on October 28, 2019, as part of UAlbany's Creative Life series. The Creative Life is created and produced by the New York State Writers Institute, University Art Museum, and UAlbany Performing Arts Center in collaboration with WAMC.
All right, all right. Pretty good, pretty good. How's everybody doing? Peace and love, peace and love. All right.
It's really great to have you here. I can't thank you enough. Those are awesome shoes.
Thank you, bro.
Yeah, what are they?
ACGs, man.
Oh, they're nice.
Nike makes them real comfortable, man.
So at what point do you think to yourself, all right, I'm a quiet guy. I don't talk about myself a lot. I don't really enjoy that part of this process. I'm laid back. I know I'm going to write a book about me.
Took 33 years. People used to always come up to me, yo, Ron, it's time to write a book. I never felt that I was interested enough, you know what I mean, or interesting enough, and hesitated on it for quite some years, man. But what I did with the book is found a way to speak more about my career than myself in the creative process, so I thought it was important to do that.
When you think about who you are who you are as an artist,
yes.
It seems as though it is so directly has to do with the writing.
Yes. I always try to see the world through the listener's eyes, and hopefully they can put themselves in my place when I wrote. So to me, it was all about the writing and just that connection with the audience.
There's a part in this book, you're talking about the fame. And when you started to hit, and you say, when we weren't on stage, I stood in the wings watching other acts and taking little cues and hints, but I was mostly watching the crowd and how they reacted to different moments of the show. Every night the energy blew me away. We quickly realized that everything was choreographed and rehearsed, but you had to make it look new every time. I love performing, but I was so calm and cool on stage that my audience couldn't be certain that I really wanted to be up there. After years of fighting to be laid back, I had to learn how to amp myself up a bit. It was cool to be low energy on records, but on stage I was coming across too casual. That was even something that you heard early on. You at your very, very first, when you started to record, they said, hey, man, get
a little more energy.
Yeah. Put more energy into it.
Yeah.
By the way, you seem a little relaxed now.
Very. Very. You know what I mean? It helps, man. It helps. I had to find myself and make sure that I was expressing myself in the right way. And, you know, I was aware that, you know, when you start doing something, a lot of times, you know, people around you try to influence you or give you opinions that may not be always right for you. So I had to learn how to, you know, kind of hold my guns and stick to what I was doing.
Now, I don't want to name any names, but Marley Marl.
Marley Marl, yeah.
All right. So, says to you, hey, why don't you stand up and put a little energy into it and stop sitting down and sleeping your way through this thing?
Exactly. I told him I could stand up, stand on the couch. It was going to sound the same way.
Now, you're how old are you at this point?
17.
So where do you get the balls to do that?
Where my brother at?
Where is your brother? There's his brother.
But yeah, you know, family, you know, brought me up right, man. Mom and pop taught me well. And, you know, just kind of confident, a little egotistical, all writers have to be, a little narcissist, but kind of, you know, in my ways.
I can see how that it would be perceived as that. However, the thing that you point out in the book, which I think is brilliant, is that, well, look, you want me to be natural. You want me to be me.
Right.
And this is me.
This is me.
Right.
Word up.
So get over it. You either like me or you don't.
Word up. And I had to let that be known early so I didn't have to pretend to be somebody to, you know, get the crowd's approval or people's approval. So I just had to learn how to be myself. And again, it was rough in the beginning. Hip hop is, you know, real energetic. A lot of the rappers screaming and, you know, a lot of energy. So I just had to find my mold and over-exaggerate my coolness, I guess. You know?
Do you, when you think about, because I read that little part where you were on stage and you're starting to be on big tours at this point, but when you were in the street and you were performing and you were a kid and you're going from place to place, that was just natural, but you could amp it up then, right?
Then you're not so worried about, you know, how you sound. You're not so worried about if you mess up. You're not so worried about doing a great job. You know, it's more organic. You rhyming in the park, bunch of your friends out there. You might freestyle, mess up a couple rhymes, but, you know, you don't care. But when you're writing songs and you're doing stuff that's going to stick to your career, you know what I mean, and stick with people, you want to make sure that it's more, you know, thought out.
So how do you feel about freestyling?
I love freestyling. It kind of keeps you sharp.
But then for you, it is writing, and then it's, once you've written it down, then you memorize it, and then you know it.
Well, my process is a little different. When I write my rhymes, once I pass a word, that's it. I'm on to the next word.
You're done.
So I don't memorize my rhyme. I read my rhyme when I get in the booth. I'm so focus on finishing or the next word that I don't even go back to the beginning and say the rhyme as I'm writing. I'm just focused on where I'm going and where I'm at the moment. If I go back to the beginning, sometimes it might take me out of my frame of thought.
So a writer, I'm sure even in this book, there's an editing process. So do you do a form of that?
Yeah. It's funny, like one of the things I always say, if there was something I can do different, would be to memorize my rhymes before I went into the booth. I always went to the booth and read my rhymes. It's a lot better when you can memorize the rhyme than you own it. You can say it the way you want, put a little style on it, change it up, you know, flip it around from here to there. But I would write, and when I get in a booth, sometimes I would put dots on the paper to know where I could take a breath and kind of figure it out in the booth, but my process was a little different. The main thing was getting it down on paper with me, and then, you know, hopefully the booth, you know, will come easy.
So from the time you write it down to the time you go to the booth, that can be any amount of time, right?
Yeah.
First rhyme had to do with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, I couldn't help it, you know. Yeah, you know what I mean? I think I was six, seven. But back then, nursery rhymes was big. It was, you know, Donald Duck.
They're still big.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It came back.
Yeah,
But, you know, back then, you know, the nursery rhymes was real big. And somehow I had the Mickey Mouse rhyme, man. And it's funny how I remember that rhyme. I can't even remember some of the rhymes that's on my record.
Do you mind sharing that with us?
The Mickey Mouse rhyme?
Yes.
That's going to cost you, man. That's cool. That's special. That's gonna cost you there.
No, I know.
But yeah, man, it's funny.
This
man.
Isn't special to you?
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I guess if you say it like that, I'm going to have to say it.
All right.
But yeah, man, you know, I don't want to bore nobody, man, but this big, my first rhyme was, and my brother will probably laugh. Mickey Mouse, he built a house, he built it by the border. An earthquake came, rocked his crib, and now it's in the water.
7 years old, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Mickey Mouse rhyme, hold on.
We spoke with Rakim on stage on October 28th as part of UAlbany's Creative Life series. His new book is Sweat the Technique.
You know, one of the things that I thought was fascinating in reading the book was your inspirations. And I was expecting to read about inspirations in the music industry, which you certainly haven't here. But I was expecting to hear, these incredible stories about musicians, which I want to get to your family lineage and the music that you grew up with, because that is a fascinating story in and of itself.
Yes.
The two people you write an entire chapter about, Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali.
Hold up.
Fighters. So what was it about them that lured how old kid to their work?
Bruce Lee, I remember the first time, like, getting up on Bruce Lee, you know, martial arts was, like, brand new. And I remember Batman. Real young, watching Batman with my brother. And every now and then, this kid named Kato used to come on. Bruce Lee used to come on and kick ass, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And nobody really knew, you know, what was going on, who he was. But I remember my brother be like, yeah, Kato was on this episode, Kato. I'm like, what? So when I started getting up on it, you know, then, you know, I was waiting for Kato to come on Batman. Then he started making movies, and I started to see Enter the Dragon and Fist of Fury and all these movies, and was just, you know, in awe of his skill. And then once I realized that it was a movie, I realized that he, you know, not only was he good enough to do it, but he, you know, orchestrated the movie and the moves and you know, made it look like, you know, it was happening, man. So just to see, you know, his artistry and how good he was, and to be a little kid, you know, you wanted to fight like him, you wanted to kick like him, you wanted to, you know, do everything. But then as I got a little older, maybe a little, you know, maybe 8, 9, I started realizing that he was more mental than he was physical. He would say things and, you know, I would sit there and I had to ask him, like, yo, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? But, you know, he was real mental, man. And I realized that anything you do, you know, has to come from the mental first. Anything you're passionate about, even if it's football, basketball, karate, whatever it is, the more skilled people are the people to take it more mentally. You know what I mean?
And you even say in the book that he was smart but spiritual.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah. That was important, as was Muhammad Ali.
Indeed. So two people that was at the top of their craft, but, you know, they had a deeper drive and a great understanding of life. And, you know, they not only, you know, affected us with their work, but affected us with their intelligence as well.
You were born in 1968.
Yes, sir.
And in January of 1968, I was born in December 1967. So you and I basically same age.
No doubt.
So the reason I bring that up, because besides, you look better than I do. But okay. because it could have ended up like this. But the other point, which is more important,
give me a little time. Give me a little time.
Yeah. But the other point is that when I was growing up, Muhammad Ali, I mean, every weekend, Wide World of Sports,
yeah.
I mean, he was like, he was God. I mean, you watched him every weekend. He didn't move without talking to people.
Yeah, and you know, being a kid, I remember it was a movie out called The Greatest, and Ali acted and starred in it.
Yeah.
I remember being a little kid, I remember watching a movie on my mother and father's floor. In awe of the whole movie. I don't think I got up one time while the movie was playing. But I remember when the movie went off and learning, that's the first time I knew, you know, how dedicated he was, you know, and the activist that he was and all the other things.
Right.
Before that, I just knew, you know, he was nice with the rhymes and he was nice with his hands. But watching that movie, I learned a lot. Can't remember the year it came out, but I remember I was real young. And when the movie went off, they played this song called The Children of the Future. I remember sitting there, you know, fight just went off, you know, felt like doing push-ups, just going outside, going outside beating somebody up. But the movie goes off, they cut this song on, and I'm sitting there watching it, and they just showing, you know, mad pictures of Ali and kind of like a collage of his life. And the song is playing, and I'm sitting there, and I go from screw face to, you know, my eyes teared up. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, why am I about to cry? Like, you know, what's going on? But just understanding, you know, what kind of person he was and what he went through to get where he was and, you know, all the stripes, you know, you think it's all good when you watch him in a, you know, ring and he win and he put his hands up, say a nice rhyme. But when you see his story and you see the struggle that people have to go through to get there, you know, and again, I'm sitting there, you know, looking around the room, making sure nobody see me tearing up. But, you know, the movie, you know, definitely hit me, man. So, you know, it's always been my hero, and he always, you know, resonated with me to a point where I try to, you know, understand what he stood for, you know, and relive his ideologies and you know, be just as good.
Did you ever get to meet him or see him?
We was in a building in California. He was real sick at the time.
Yeah.
So just to see him walk by, I was, you know, I was just in awe. I spoke to his people. They came over and kind of spoke to me for him. But I remember when I seen him, and I just had so much respect for him, and I knew, you know, he was real sick.
Right.
I didn't want to approach him and, you
but
know.
But just to be in that
presence. Yeah, man, I just watched him walk, like, the whole time, and just, like, my whole childhood flashed, you know, in front of me, man. But, you know, I owe a lot to him and his family for the sacrifices and the things he did.
You're very close to your mom and dad.
Big time.
And, you know, growing up in my house, my mother and father almost constantly played jazz records. And, man, Ruth Brown was the woman. I mean, that was amazing.
Big time.
And that's your aunt.
Hold up.
It was
dope growing up and
I mean,
being
you,
in her presence.
Did you... Which side of the family was she related?
She was close to my mom.
Your mom.
We called her.
So did you know how famous she was?
Not at first. She used to babysit me. So I used to go to her house and, you know, I knew she was on records.
Yeah.
Little kid, I would go over there. She just chilling, you know, watching her, you know, soap operas, whatever it was, eating Slim Jims. Well, this bald, I could see, you know, I could smell the perfume like right now. But I remember sitting there and just like watching her. And she ain't know I used to just watch her all the time because she was so cool. I would like wonder, like, she'd be in there chilling, watching me. That night, she got to go to Manhattan to the Cotton Club. So I'm sitting there watching her. She's watching a show, commercial come on. She'll go grab some clothes, throw it on her artistry desk where she did her artwork, throw some clothes, you know, a dress on there, come back, watch TV, eat a Slim Jim. Commercial come on, she go grab some shoes, pocketbook, throw that on the table as well, come back, watch the show, get another break, she would go get some glue, go in there, take the glue, squeeze it out, real quick design, I'm looking like, come back, sit down, let that sit for a second, come back with the glitter.
Art and craft time with Aunt Ruth.
Whole outfit. You know what
wow.
I mean? Whole outfit. Glittered out, shoes, pocketbook, hat, if it was a hat to go with it. But she would go buy regular nice things, man, and make it look like, you know, she bought it for stage after she finished with it.
Wow.
But, and, you know, I'm a little kid, you know, messing things up, dropping stuff. And she just chilling, man, making her clothes, watching TV, eating her favorite snack, playing with her dog. Dog name was Herda. I couldn't believe that she can do that and then go do a show, as cool as she was. There was no, you know, remnants of a show. Like, she's in there, natural, laid back. And I adopted that, you know what I mean? I felt that you know, that was the way to do it. Just, you know, go about your day. Make sure you got your, you know, little routine, but make sure that you, you know, laid back. And
5 number one hits, and then she gets a Tony Award.
Hold up.
I mean, that's just an amazing career.
Yes.
She saw your success?
Yes.
Yeah.
Me and my mom went and seen her at the Blue Note in Manhattan. You know, I was maybe a few years deep. The funny thing is in the book, I think I mentioned when my mom and pop had to come sign me at a school.
Yeah.
My mom called my aunt and was, you know, broke it down. She was like, you know, Popo was my nickname. She, you know, Popo got a chance to, you know, get a contract and such, and it's blowing up quick, and, you know, we have to take him out of school. What you think? And my aunt was like, well, if it's to the point where, you know, you got to sign him out of school, let him go. I had to make my mom's a promise, but she came up on my pop, signed me out of school.
What was the promise?
I'm supposed to get a GED.
I'm guessing from that response, you didn't get it.
I ain't get it yet, man. I'm working on it.
We're speaking to rap legend Rakim. His new book is Sweat the Technique, Revelations on Creativity from the Lyrical Genius.
Yeah. The return of the wild style fashion is smashing hits, make it hard to adapt to this. Put pizzazz and jazz in this, the cash in this, master this, blast this, and make a clap to this. DJs don't want cuts and obey the crowd, just pump the volume up and play it loud. Hip hop's embedded, before I said I wouldn't let it, but me and the microphone is still magnetic. Straight off the top, I knew I'd be forced to rock. Dead floor to stop, the spot scorching hot. When I open, rockin' my law seminars, massage at the bar, smoking 10-hour cigars while I'm my meaties. With more vision than TVs, I find it easy catching diabetes for fly sweeties. Sit back and wait to hear slamming track. Rock a jam by popular demand, I'm back.
We spoke with Rakim on stage on October 28th as part of UAlbany's Creative Life series. His new book is Sweat the Technique.
Both your mom and dad are passed, right?
Yes.
I mean, and those things become more important now than they were. Indeed, I mean, so. I know both my parents are gone. And you think, oh, God, you know, you start trying to fulfill all that stuff.
Indeed. So, you know, I live like, you know, like I still find myself, you know, trying to please them. You know, whatever I do, even, you know, I can have a conversation with my kids and, you know, the thought comes over me like, did I do it the right way? You know, is my mom's and pop's proud of the way I'm, you know, not only, you know, handling my business, but taking care of family at home, too.
When they signed you out of school, I mean, you were how old? You were
17.
17. Yeah. But you had already, you had already figured out what you want to do. I mean, you were out making music and doing okay in the sense of learning your craft.
Well, not professionally. It kind of came quick. I went and recorded the record maybe a couple months later. It was on the radio. Weeks after that, we was doing shows, and then we was asked to go on tour. That's when I had to get signed out of school. But it happened so quick. You know, it wasn't promised. It was kind of like,
right.
Well, he has an opportunity. It's going pretty good right now. And
so let me just back up a little bit. So you're 11 years old, and you have a gun. And You shoot yourself in the groin. First of all, how does that happen?
Well, I got, y'all gonna have to get the book. Since he brought it up, I gotta tell y'all what happened.
Right.
Kinda quick, still gotta get the book.
Yeah, but why did you need, you're 11, why do you need a gun?
My brother. Nah, I ain't gonna blame that on my brother.
Okay.
I came up quick. I came up, you know, but I was 11. I was rhyming with kids that was in high school and kids that was in college. I was going to parties out of town and all over the place. And I was only 11, so something gave me the bright idea that I would get that for protection. Long story short, I was in a bodega. Cops came in a bodega. I had a gun in my back pocket, and cops seen the gun. I went out the store, was on my way to the park. I tried to go through the path to the park. Cops came out the store. wanted to chase me in the path, but I was already in the path, so they backed up and was going to meet me around the other end of the path. So me being smart, I didn't want to get rid of the gun. Being that I was young, I know I can lie and say, yo, this gun don't work. I found it around the corner. But I needed to get the bullets out. I took the bullets out the clip, made me a little hole, put the bullets in the hole because I was coming back for those. I only had 9. Put the dirt over it, put a bottle over the hole that I dug so I can find it when I come back. I went to take a bullet out the chamber, and being that it was a 20-25 automatic, yeah, low caliber, you got to clean those every day. I didn't know that.
Well, you're 11. You mean,
yeah, 11.
You know, and clean your room, for God's sake.
All I know is it looked good when I pull it out.
All right. Read about
that. I try to get the bullet out the chamber. It's stuck in the chamber. When I open up the gun, the bullet comes halfway out. So I try to close it, open it back up, and it's stuck. So I figured out, push it closed, open it back up. I went to push it, and I guess the force of me pushing it closed hit the back of the bullet, came out the open end of the gun, backwards. I had the gun like this, came out the open end, hit me in the leg. Real close. I do have kids, luckily. World up.
Man.
But you
talk in the book about having to call your mom and telling you what you did. It was like, oh, my
God.
Your mom and dad. Yeah.
Yeah, well, luckily my pops wasn't home when I got there, which was good. Handling one parent at a time is a little easier, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, it was a learning experience.
What struck me is, because you talk in the book about it's just a couple weeks before Christmas, and you get the Sears catalog, like we all did when we were kids.
Load up, yeah.
And, I mean, that Wish book came in. Man, that thing was gold.
Your eyes got big, you know what I mean?
There was nothing better than that.
World up.
So you go and you start circling all of the audio equipment.
Yeah.
You want turntables and speakers and mics.
About $6,000 worth of equipment.
Yeah. And your mom says, well, I don't know who's going to pay for this.
World up.
What I think is interesting is that so a year later they do get you turntables.
Yeah, they worked it out, and you know, I saved up a little bit here and there, and you know, I was able to go get a nice pair of cheap joints, and, you know, good enough for, you know, me. I'm, you know, a little kid at the time, too.
Yeah, and then about a year later, you get the gun.
Yeah. See how that works, right?
Yeah,
you get the equipment. Trying to, you know, be a kid, fit in. And, you know, again, I wasn't stupid. I was in the hood, you know, going places where, you know, I wasn't known. And, you know, that was my way of being protected.
So how do you meet Eric B?
One of my good friends, Alvin Tony, brought Eric B to my house one day, and took him downstairs and played him a tape that I made. I thought I was going to be a football player. I made a tape so when I go to college, when the MCs in college start beefing, I can just put my tape in, sit back. Yeah. But, you know, made the tape, and Eric B. comes by, and my man Alvin Tony was like, yo, he knows Mr. Magic and Marley Marl. Mr. Magic was the DJ for 107.5
right
at the time.
You're growing up in Long Island. We should mention
that. Wild Dance, Long Island. So I let him downstairs, played him, you know, some of the tape, and he starts telling me, like, yeah, you know, we can go to Marley Marl's house and make a record. I was like, you know, I don't know if I want to, you know, do that. At this time, I'm kind of content with not making a record. You know what I mean? I'm in 11th grade. You know, you kind of wake up one day and you're like, yeah, that's not going to happen, man. You know what I mean? Yeah, I better stick to this football, which is funny. Because, you know, I thought I was going to be a quarterback. And, you know, quarterbacks is 6'5", 240 pounds. And I'm about half of that, so things happen for a reason. Hold on. But my man Alvin Tony brings Eric B to the house. I played him the songs. You know, we can go to Marley house, this and that. So I told him, you know, I was trying to be a football player. So he was like, well, we can make a record, and you can just be guests to the record. He's like, yeah, you don't have to sign. It'd be Eric B. featuring Rakim. And, you know, you can make this record, and then you can go to college to play football. So, you know, I was like, okay, I get to knock two birds out of one stone. Make the record and go play quarterback, right? We meet up. He comes back to the house maybe a month later, and we go to Queensbridge. We take the train to Queensbridge, to Marley Marl's house. Make the first record, The Melody, which was on the tape that I played him when he came to the house. The Melody was like one of the first rhymes I wrote when I started like really trying to get serious with my craft. Did that first, and again, Marley Marl was trying to tell me, yo, could you stand up, Lord? A little more energy in it, man. But yeah, it's a blessing, man. Went and made the song, and did Eric B. as president maybe a week after that.
What do you think of that title?
What do I think of Eric B. as president?
Yeah.
It was all right.
We're speaking with Rakim, who began his career as the MC of the rap duo Eric B. and Rakim. He's the author of the new book, Sweat the Technique. We spoke with him in October 2019 as part of UAlbany's Creative Life series.
What was the division of labor between the two of you?
I don't know, man. We didn't know each other much, really, at all. We just knew that, you know, to be a group, you know, it's a union, it's a DJ, and, you know, me being a rapper. And we just tried to, you know, meet on common grounds and, you know, make songs that we thought would resonate with hip hop.
You go, I mean, to the height, and what's fascinating, and you write about in the book, and you certainly don't have to go into it here, but you go in and you have this great success, and then you break up, which seems inevitable. I mean, many partnerships seem to go that route. Very, very few artistic partnerships, and the culprit is usually money.
Yeah.
But you're able to, like now, from what I was looking at, you performed with them just last weekend.
Yeah.
So you're able to, do you put all that aside? Do you have to bury the hatchet? Do you just say, this is business, we're going to go see each other, you stay in that room, I'll stay in this room, and I'll see you out on stage?
Well, I think, like with myself, you know, I was bitter, you know, a long time about the situation. He came up with a plan that kind of backfired when it was my turn to get the justice from the plan. He backed out of the deal. And, you know, I was bitter for a long time. I'm a loyal person, and I'm also firm on principle. And, you know, for a long time, you know, I didn't want to, you know, deal with him. There's a bunch of deals that came about that I turned down for the simple fact. But as time went on, you kind of grow, you mature, you really learn, you know, what's important, put things in perspective. And I think I realized that it was bigger than me and him. People that supported us and showed us love and got us to this point wanted to see us on stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I buried the hatchet, and I took the goons off him, man.
Did he ever apologize?
Nah. He
what did you want to hear from him?
Just, you know, I f***ed up. That's all he had to say. You know what I mean? Excuse my language, y'all, but
no, well, that's,
you know, he didn't have to, you know, Rob, man, my bad. And I would have probably cut it at that, you know what I mean? But just, you know, just want him to, you know, take responsibility, and not only that, just, you know, admit to what he did.
There's another great story in the book. It ends the book, really. It's toward the end of the book, where you talk about working with Dr. Dre. Yeah. Now, I won't make you tell the story, because I know you tell it a million times, and I think people should get the book and read the story. Let me just ask you this question. From your experience in the hip-hop world, do most people have a Dr. Dre is a weasel story?
Oh, man. Let's see if they got...
He's not here.
Well, I ain't looking for Dre. I'm looking looking for media. Something. This is a setup. This is a setup.
I mean, you walked away, right? I mean, you said, look, this isn't working for me.
Yeah.
It's great. This could be something. This would be fantastic, but this isn't going to work out.
Yeah, well done.
He had a million things going, and your time wasn't coming. And I assume you had already been, you were kind of waiting for your end from your first partner, and now you got this guy, and you're thinking, all right, well, I'm moving on.
Back at it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But then do people come up to you and say, oh, Rob, man, this is...
Yeah,
all right.
Dr. Dre, man, good dude, man, good dude. Good businessman, you know, made a bunch of good records. Just me and him couldn't see eye to eye, man. But I wish him the best, man.
Well, isn't that, don't you think you reach a point in life where you just, that all that goes by and you're like, all right, I got my deal, you've got your deal, I'm just going to go do what I'm going to do.
World up, man. And, you know, I'm one of them cats that, you know, glass is half full. I also believe things happen for a reason. And, you know, what's meant to happen will happen. If it don't, keep it moving. And I don't fly. I drive. So it was a long ride home from Cali back to the East Coast. But I tell you, by the time I got halfway home, I already knew what I was going to do. You know what I mean? And, you know, sit in the car, you know, you got your family with you, and you ain't got nothing to do but this right here. So by the time I hit Chicago, I was like this. Yeah, I'm ready now. You know what I mean? Like, I knew I had to come home, I had to build the studio up, and I had to do it myself.
A couple things, just to wrap up. One is, you talk about this toward the end of the book, Hollywood comes calling, and they always want you to play a thug, and you're like, I'm good. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want that.
Did that.
And so you took the high road there, I think, and then most places you did take the high road.
Yeah.
How hard is it? Because you also talk about the difference. I mean, not only East Coast, West Coast, but you even talk about what it was like to come out of Long Island.
Yeah.
I mean, just that in and of itself, because people don't think of like a hood in Long Island.
Right. You know what I mean? If it wasn't Brooklyn, Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, or, you know what I mean? You was like alienized. But I had to, you know, let them know that I'm here. You know what I mean? And you know, I wasn't going nowhere. And, you know, just move over a little bit. I'm a little dude. I don't need, you know, too much room. Just let me in. You know, just let me in. I'm all right. But, it's, you know, trying to make your name in the business and, you know, trying to, you know, myself. I didn't want to feed the stereotypes. People used to always think I was a drug dealer. To the point where I thought I was a drug dealer. You know what I mean? Like,
you have a great line in the book where you go, which was not saying anything because some of my best friends are drug dealers.
Yeah,
like, one of my favorite lines of the book.
You know, but it's like, you know, after a while, people, you know, keep pointing the finger to the point where I found myself justifying it. Like, come on, man. And I realized, like, yo, it feels like I'm a drug dealer and I'm trying to tell this person I'm not. So after that, I got, you know, real upset and learned a new way to deal with it.
Yeah. You talk about sort of how things change for you, and this is at the very end of the book. After the L.A. riots, the most important MCs in the game were L.A. rappers like Snoop, Dr. Dre, and Ice Cube. Their music seemed to come directly out of the environment and the energy that had led to the riots, and it seemed to take on a deeper significance for the nation that was again contemplating the crisis facing a neglected segment of society. Mm-hmm. They wanted you to be angrier and to be responding, and you didn't. That wasn't you.
No, I felt the way I was supposed to feel when it happened. It took place. And I didn't think it needed to be glorified by everybody. Some things need to happen for change, but you don't have to glorify
right.
some of them things because they all are not good. Some of them are, you know what I mean? I remember, you know, because I watched it. And I remember sitting there, and I remember when the truck pulled up, 18-wheeler.
Right.
And I remember my man got out, and I remember they hit him in the head with that brick. Come on, man. To me, that was senseless. Like I said, certain things have to be done for change, but I didn't want to glorify it no more than it was.
But and it's a nonviolent approach, right? I mean, it's to be an activist of nonviolence.
Yeah, you know.
Which of course goes back again. I have to make the connection to Muhammad Ali in that.
Yeah, hold up.
Yeah.
And
The final thing that I want to bring up with you, which I think is one of the most fascinating things of your life and of this point in your life, is that, you're 51 years old, whether you like it or not, you become like an elder statesman of hip hop.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you point out is that isn't always welcome, is it?
Nah, not in this genre.
That sucks.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if it's the pressure that the media puts on the kids. They make it seem like the young artists have something to do with the outcome of the older rappers. You know what I mean? That's the problem. But it's more on the media. You know, than the younger rappers. But the media makes the younger rappers feel like they're suppressing the older rappers or, you know, the underground hip hop from getting played. They just making the music that they like to make. The media and the radio station and the labels is the ones that's, you know, the reason of what gets played. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think, you know, they doing what they like to do. They, you know, they young right now. Let them do what they want to do.
I mean, that's part of it. You were young, too.
Yeah.
We were all young.
Right.
And you got to go out into life and get batted around a little bit before you know what's going on.
I tell people all the time, in the Bronx, even, you know, when hip-hop was young in the Bronx, it was hip-hop, hip-hop, but you don't stop. You what? And we was like this, you know what I mean? And then it went from that to, you know, Melly Mel, a child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through. And those are some of the illest words I heard, you know what I mean? Coming from hip, the hop, the hibbit, to that. So hopefully it'll do the same, you know, on all the, you know, down south and all these other places where it's at.
But for people like me and for, I think, for many people in this audience, they look at you and they think, I think to myself, well, man, they don't make them like they used to.
Yes. Thank you, bro. Thank you.
We spoke with Rakim on stage on October 28th. As part of UAlbany's Creative Life series, The Creative Life is created and produced by the New York State Writers Institute, University Art Museum, and UAlbany Performing Arts Center in collaboration with WAMC, Northeast Public Radio.